Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back for season two of Sharkpedia.
Welcome back.
Woo-hoo! We are so excited to be starting off this season with the amazing Jake Jerome. Jake, would you like to introduce yourself to our sharkies?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Jake Jerome. I work for the wonderful organization Field School, which I know Megan and Imani have talked about on the podcast before, but mostly focus on shark stress physiology, which is what we're going to talk about today.
Yay! Yes, we're so excited. And we are going to be breaking down Jake's article that's titled Integrating Reflexes with Physiological Measures to Evaluate Coastal Shark Stress Response to Capture. And that was Jerome et al. In 2017. So the summary for this article that we're going to go over today is to better understand physiological stress response to capture, Jerome et al. Used conventional blood physiology endpoints such as glucose, lactate, and hematocrit and assessed five reflex responses on sandbar sharks, blacktip sharks, great hammerhead sharks, and nurse shark species after capture. Their objectives were to test for relationships between physiological variables, hooking and hooking duration, shark species, and body size, and evaluate for relationships between reflex impairments and hook time, species, and body size, and determine if there are any relationships between the physiological parameter and those reflex impairments. Physiological stress response varied widely between the four species, with nurse sharks constantly displaying the lowest level of physiological disturbance and great hammerheads displaying the highest, which I'm really excited to break down. It's no surprise to people that know those species, but I'm excited to talk to Jake about why those species responded that way. And they also found that lactate was the most consistent and useful indicator for determining stress in all species. This research is especially important for better understanding the physiological response sharks have to being caught either recreationally or catch and release fishing or commercial fishing. We're super excited to break this down, and physiology is my jam, so we're stoked to have a physiology episode.
Yes, so excited. So let's just start with the first question, which is that fish experience stress just like we experience stress, but it shows up differently. So can you just briefly explain what stress looks like in sharks, and why is stress physiology such an important field of research?
Yeah, so whenever we talk about physiological stress, we're talking about changes in bodily function. So for humans, we think about stress as in, you know, you didn't turn in your paper, you're late for class, whatever it might be. Those might cause stress in your life, right? Your palms get sweaty. You have bodily functions that are affected. For sharks, similar things happen, but it's a change in a lot of the tissues and enzyme levels. So those alterations can actually affect their fitness, and that's why it's kind of important to study these. If you have different stressors, whether they be abiotic or biotic, so human-induced or natural, if you will, those can affect their fitness overall.
So why did you decide to use both the blood parameters when you're looking at stress physiology and then also those reflex impairments to assess capture stress in the sharks? Why is it important to use both and not just one or the other?
So for this study, we wanted to look at some of the reflex impairments that have been previously shown to be kind of proxies or indications of stress in teleost or bony fish. And what we wanted to do is try to see if that was the same case for sharks. So trying to compare those physiological endpoints, things like lactate, glucose, hematocrit, and see if those can be a proxy for stress in terms of the reflex impairments themselves.
Yeah, that's awesome. And can you kind of explain, I think, more in detail what those reflexes are? I kind of went over them briefly in the summary, but I feel like it'd be good to hear from you, like what you were measuring and how you measured that.
Yeah, so for the reflexes in the sharks that we sampled, we kind of worked off of some previous research on bony fish and tried to find reflexes or behaviors that we thought might be impacted by stress. So one of them was the retrieval of the shark. So when you're bringing it to the boat, is it actively swimming? Is it kind of just being kind of like this dead log being dragged to the boat? What is this behavior while you're bringing it in? The second was a nictitating membrane. So for our crocodilian species, they have this kind of like second or this eyelid essentially that is an involuntary reflex. So if you squirt water in their eye or if you touch around their eye, it will kind of fire. And that serves as a protection for the sharks whenever they're feeding. So trying to measure that involuntary reflex. We also had a jaw reflex. So whenever we have the sharks on the boat, I kind of noticed that they would kind of clench their jaws, essentially. So whenever we put a pump in their mouth, so most of our sharks are ram ventilators, so they have to have a water pipe, essentially, a pacifier, if you will, in their mouth so that we can have water flowing over their gills the entire time. So the jaw reflex is looking at how clenched their jaw was in that process of putting the pump in. Another was the gill reflex. So we also noticed on the vessel that there was this kind of gill musculature movement. Essentially, they're trying to move water over their gills, and that would happen throughout the workup. And so seeing if that was impaired, as well as a kind of flex or body impairment. So in the time that we're working the shark, what is its behavior on the vessel? So is it actively moving? Is it just kind of sitting there? So those were the five reflexes. So a retrieval, nictitating membrane, jaw, gill, and a body flex.
And were there any other reflexes that you could have tested for impairments, or are those generally the five that you think would be most indicative of a stress response?
So most of the previous work has been on small teleost or bony fish, right? So there are reflexes like a riding reflex, where you flip a fish upside down and see if it can turn itself back upright. We can't really do that with large sharks, right? So we had to modify these reflexes. So this was really a kind of preliminary study to see how these reflexes are impaired in the stressful situations and if they could be used as proxies or indicators of that stress.
So you mentioned that the study that you kind of based this on was for teleost fish. And I'm wondering why, if you know or any guesses, why there might have not been as many shark physiology stress response papers published at the time of publishing this paper.
I think for the reflexes in particular, it has to do with logistics. Whenever you're working with large animals, it can be difficult to test these reflexes in those situations. In some of the smaller benthic species, in an aquarium maybe, it's a little bit easier to test those. So there has been, you know, some work on reflexes in some benthic species, as well as lemon sharks, but this was kind of the first one to look at some of these larger coastal species.
And I was super curious when I was reading about how you kind of categorized the reflexes. The retrieval reflex I wanted to ask you about, in my experience, different species will behave differently, right? Like a great hammerhead is going to respond a lot differently than, you know, a nurse shark, for example. So did you have to kind of normalize or reference, you know, the response, one of those reflex responses based on the species and kind of cater it to each species?
Yeah, definitely. So we looked at the reflexes by species, and then also we grouped them as well in the statistics. So looking to see four great hammerheads, is that retrieval kind of more probable to be altered or not? And so, yeah, definitely looked at it by species.
Awesome.
And one of the key things from this paper is that you drew blood from sharks. Now, I don't know how many people know how you draw blood from sharks, so can you please explain how you even go about doing that?
Yeah, so it depends a lot on the species you're working with or the environment where you're trying to take this blood sample. But in general, you usually go for the caudal vein or precaudal vein. So right where the tail is, that's another name for that is the caudal fin. And so you're looking, you basically have to lift up the tail and insert the needle close to the surface of the skin there. And that's where you're going to get a pretty good, reliable blood sample from that area. There are other places where you can draw blood from sharks, but for the research that we do and the vessel that we work on, that seemed to be the most reliable for us.
And is it challenging? Is it hard?
It can be, yeah. So I like to say that it's, 50% skill, 50% luck a little bit. There's some sharks where you just cannot get them to bleed. Whereas there's others where, you can close your eyes and go in blinded and draw blood right away. So it depends a little bit, but it can be difficult. Definitely takes a lot of practice and training.
I would just like to take this moment to note that Jake is a vampire and is extremely good at collecting blood from sharks. And there has been more times than one that I am just in awe of exactly how fast he can draw blood at the beginning and end of a workup. Like, completely shookamani.
It took a lot of practice for sure.
Yeah, I got to see that in person as well, and it was awesome. And also, I don't know if many people know this, but Jake is the one that really helped me learn how to draw blood too over video. He like talked me through it and showed me lots of pictures. And actually, Jake, I'm really proud to say that some of my coworkers started calling me Shark Vampire, and I was like, that's
Yes.
Jake's nickname.
I love it. I love it so much. My legacy continues.
Yeah, I'm doing my best to become mini Jake.
So you use some blood endpoints, which we want to describe for our listeners who don't know these three endpoints and why they're useful. So you used glucose, lactate, and hematocrit. Can you just briefly explain each one of those and why they're important for shark stress research?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll start to say, or I'll start with that. Stress physiology is very complicated. One increase or decrease in one of these parameters does not equal stress. But what they do is kind of provide us with a little piece of the puzzle. So, what we measured was, like you said, glucose, lactate, and hematocrit. Glucose is a metabolite that is generally used for energy. So, increases or decreases can be affected by stress event. Lactate is a byproduct of anaerobic respiration. So, whenever you can't produce or you're trying to produce energy, but you don't have enough oxygen available, lactate or lactic acid is produced. So, think about if you go for a run or you work out, your muscles are sore, you have that buildup of lactic acid in your blood and in your muscles. And the same thing happens to our sharks. So, looking to see how exercise stress is impacted. I'm sorry. Looking at exercise stress and lactate can be affected by that. In terms of hematocrit, we're looking at the percentage or volume of red blood cells compared to the total volume of blood. And this is important because red blood cells carry oxygen, right? So if you can deliver more oxygen to your muscles, theoretically, you may be able to produce more energy or go through a stress event for a longer period of time. Hematocrit is kind of a tricky one. It's usually not a very good indicator of stress. Most of these endpoints that we use in physiology, one endpoint does not equal stress, like I said. But again, give us kind of that bigger picture of what's happening inside the sharks.
Well, one of the things that actually you taught me, Jake, that I thought was really interesting about hematocrit is that some species can mobilize more red blood cells if they are stressed, right? If they're in that anaerobic state, then they can dump red blood cells. So you might at some point, I know this, like you said, it's not like one hematocrit point isn't really an indicator of stress, but I thought it was super, super cool that sharks can, increase that red blood cell count to mobilize oxygen better.
Yeah, so for teleosts and bony fish, that is definitely true. There's been a couple really cool studies that looked at, exercise stress and related that to an increase in hematocrit. And it makes sense if we think about where red blood cells are created, right? For for our teleosts and bony fish, they're created in bones, right? Bone marrow. Our sharks don't have bones per se, right? So it's a little bit harder for them to mobilize this hermaticrit, but they still can produce it. And sometimes in some studies, you do see an increase in hermaticrit with a relation to a stress event.
That's so cool. I was doing some time series, as both of you know, but our sharkies don't necessarily know. But I've been taking blood draw of the same animal over a period of time to just see how that stress cascade occurs, similar to some things that you've done, Jake. And I've been looking for that now, you know, do the species that I'm looking at, does their hematocrit change? Because I wasn't even measuring hematocrit for every blood draw. And then you were the one that was like, no, make sure you measure that, because it could be a cool thing to see.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, bigger piece or a small piece of the bigger picture. You do have to be careful with multiple blood draws, because hematocrit can go down as you're taking red blood cells out of the shark.
Yeah, that's fair. Especially from the tiny ones.
Yes.
Little babies. Or not babies in the case of bonnet heads, where they're adults, but they're little babies.
They are little babies. I don't care what anyone else says.
So before we move on to your results and discussion, I just had one more question about your methods. So you used a drumline system with a hook timer. And hook timers are not something that we've talked about on the podcast before, and they're also not always used with drumline systems. So can you explain what the importance of the hook timer was for the stress physiology research and just research in general?
Yeah, definitely. So hook timers are essentially stopwatches that are connected to your fishing gear. So as soon as there's tension on the monofilament, it pops out a magnet and a count up starts. So it gives us an indication of how long an animal has been on the line for, or how long that stress event has taken place. So it gives us something to kind of compare our values to. So we can say, you know, a shark's been on the line for 20 minutes and we've seen these changes in these values. So it's a good way to kind of measure time on a line or the length of the stress event itself.
So that's actually a really good segue into our results and discussion with our first question from that section, which is, your total came out to 223 blood and reflex sampled sharks. And some of those lacked hook duration times. Is hook timer malfunction something that happens a lot? And is it just so useful to have for data collection that we keep using them? Or did you choose kind of halfway through to use hook timers? How did that, difference between different sharks occur?
The difference in the number of kind of hook timers per the samples was mostly due to malfunction. So anytime you're putting an electrical device into the water, you're going to come up with issues. So they can flood, they just stop working, the batteries run out, whatever it may be. It tends to lead to a lot of malfunction. We did have some fishing systems that did not have hook timers, but we still wanted to include those species in the analysis for the blood per species differences. So how did different species respond to capture stress? So we still use some of those values. And we actually have working with a local high school to 3D print some of these hook timers so that we can try to figure out a better system for ourselves. Because they are also very expensive for no reason.
That's so cool. I like how you just kind of casually glossed over that. Like, oh, we're 3D printing them. It's fine.
So cool. I love that different parts of science always somehow end up to come together and be like useful across disciplines. Also, 3D printing is just really cool.
Yeah. Can we 3D print a boat? That would be cool.
An entire vessel.
Why not? Let's do it. Okay. Well, so you found with these results that stress impacted each species pretty differently. So great hammerheads appear to be the most stressed, which is no surprise, but we should talk about that. And they showed the highest probability of showing a reflex impairment, with nurse sharks being the lowest. This is really interesting because it shows that the stress is experienced differently across species. So what explanations can you explain for this? I mean, why would one species have a stronger physiological stress response than another?
for different species, we definitely saw different responses. And a lot of that has to do with life history, behavior on a line, or even just morphology. So our nurse sharks, for example, are buccal pumpers. They take the bait, they just sit on the bottom, they kind of rest, build up all their rage until we bring them onto the boat, and then they go about their day. Whereas a great hammerhead, who has a pretty small mouth, so less water over their gills, will fight as hard and as fast as it can the entire time. Our drumline systems, the drum itself, or the weight that sits on the bottom, is about 30, 35 pounds, and we've had great hammerheads drag that across the seafloor. So they are very, very strong animals. They just want to get away as fast as they can, and that's likely why we have these differences in species. I think a lot of it is probably attributed to behavior on a line.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Do you think it would be different if you were doing hook and line, for example? Like if you just pulled them up, do you think their stress responses would be more similar, or do you think that they would still have pretty significant physiology differences between the species?
I think that it would actually be increased. The drumline systems are pretty forgiving on the animals. We use very, very thick monofilament. You hand reel all the sharks in. But in terms of, you know, stress for the fishing gear, hook and line usually causes more. And by that, I mean because of the gear itself. So usually when recreational fishers or even when we're fishing for sharks using hook and line, our gear can't always kind of handle the power and the strength of a shark. So you have to kind of work or fight it in. And so that's reeling in some line, letting some line out, reeling in some line, letting some line out. And that increases that exercise stress, right? So
Sure. That's
a longer time on the line. It can cause kind of an increase in that stress response.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I never actually thought about it that way.
Whenever, you know, we talk about recreational angling and how fishers are catching these animals, it can tend to be a little bit more stressful for them because of that gear type difference. So they're spending a longer time on the line because fishers don't want to lose their line. Or their gear, right? So they don't want to have their line snap. So they're going to kind of, you know, work the shark up or work a fish up so that they can get most of their gear back and hopefully release the shark back in good health.
So do you think that because of that, your results are probably a lot more conservative than what's actually happening?
Yeah, definitely. So this was definitely a more conservative approach. It just happened to be the fishing gear that we used for the program at the time. But I think that looking at different types of fishing gear is really important.
Yeah. So
you have drum lines, you have long lines, you have recreational or rod and reel, right? So each of those types of gear is going to have a different kind of effect on the animals.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super interesting.
So you found that lactate proved to be the most useful blood parameter because it's significantly associated with impairment for 4 of the 5 reflexes. The one that it did not significantly associate with was the nictitating membrane reflex. Why do you think that was the specific one that it didn't associate positively with?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. The nictitating membrane is a kind of tricky reflex or kind of behavior, if you will. We have caught half of a shark before, and its nictitating membrane is still firing or it's still active, right? So it's maybe not the best indicator of stress, but it was something that we wanted to test in the study to see if it would be. And so we kind of found out it wasn't. So yay, science.
We love science. I will just say, so one of the things I said in that question was that it was significantly associated with some of the reflexes. And I just want to at least try to explain to some of our sharkies what statistical significance is. And I guess in like the plainest terms that hopefully a statistician will not wreck me for, there's a bunch of different math and statistics that you can do. But it basically says that the more statistically significant something is, the less likely it is that it occurred randomly and that there's actually a specific cause for what is happening.
I think that was a great little like plain language, why stats matter.
Yeah, you nailed it.
Good job.
Fantastic.
Gold star for Mani.
I hope my stats professor next semester doesn't listen to this and is like, you know what you're doing. Why didn't you get this correct?
Nah, it'll be good. So you also, the blood parameters and the hook time are also significantly associated with some of the reflexes, but not all of the reflexes that you measured. What do you think the relevance of that is? What does that tell us about the species that you were researching?
I mean, like I mentioned before, this was a very much preliminary study for these reflexes. So we're just trying to get an idea of if they can be useful at all and what kind of physiological endpoints can be reflected in those. So what we looked at is the kind of probability of impairment in relation to some of those endpoints. So lactate, for example, which is commonly used as a kind of proxy for stress, although there's some debate about that, tended to kind of predict that probability of impairment. So the higher the lactate, the more probable it was that those reflexes were impaired. And it definitely differs between species.
So let's talk, I think, a little bit more about fighting on the line, which affects the stress levels. Great hammerheads were the only species where hook time significantly affected their probability of reflex impairment. How does this inform us for future research and even recreational policies? So kind of that bigger scope, bigger picture, what does this matter for?
Hammerheads are pretty often caught in recreational fisheries. And so if we can show that, you know, this time on the line really does impact that physiological stress or affect their fitness, if you will. So looking at kind of different regulations here in Florida or elsewhere and trying to, you know, as soon as you realize it's a hammerhead, you can cut the line. It's very complicated, but it can help to kind of give us an idea of species differences and how anglers can kind of alter their methods or can work with scientists in order to help conserve these species. Because I know you work with anglers as well, and I know you've mentioned this before, and you know they care about the animals, right? So they're not the evil person in this equation. Fishing is going to happen. I fish as well. But how can we work together in order to kind of better conserve the species?
The one thing I kind of want to emphasize that you were just talking about is that, you know, recreational fishers don't always know the physiological effects that's happening on that fish. So they might have the best intentions, but don't actually know that what they're doing might be lethal. For example, like for great hammerheads, like we keep saying, they're just this sensitive species. There's a lot of laws now where you can't even take the gills out of the water. If you just need to cut the line and let them swim because their chances of survival are much higher. Because what fishers might not know, and just the average Joe might not know, is that even if you release that animal and it swam away, it doesn't mean that they're going to live. Like some of these long-term stress responses cause them to actually die. So actually understanding what species will respond that strongly is really important also for policy, for saying we can do this with some species and they're no problem. Like nurse sharks, we kind of joke about them all the time. It seems like you can take them to the supermarket and back and they're having a grand old day, but hammerheads not so much.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, it's definitely species specific, but getting that information out to anglers, I think, is also important. And something that we're looking to start doing very, very soon is start trying to work with some of these anglers that are fishing on the beaches here in Florida, and whether it's posting signage or talking to them individually, but just trying to, again, work together, collaborate. There's a lot of stakeholders, a lot of different interests. And I think it's really important for everybody to work together, because we all have the same goal in mind, and that's to conserve the species, right? If there's no sharks, then they can't fish. If there's no fish, then they can't fish.
Yeah, it's true.
We'll cut that out.
I'm keeping it in.
Monty. That was, oh, I'm crying. God. That was such a Jake moment.
Then they can't fish. Oh, if there's no fish, then they can't fish. I love it. It is staying in here. I mean, it's facts.
It's big facts. It's big facts. Big, big facts.
I'm fine. It's fine. I'm fine. So when you release a shark, either after research or for fishing purposes, at what point, or I guess, do we know at what point we can say that they're starting to recover from the stress that they experienced?
Short answer is not really. It, again, like everything that we do here, depends on the species, but you know, that's some of the work that we're starting to do with field school, is looking at some of these juvenile nurse sharks and their recovery potential. So doing recreational angling, putting them in a pen and seeing where those variables kind of level out. Do they start to decline? Are they still increasing? It's really, really hard to do that with larger animals. You can't put a 12-foot gray hammerhead in a pen, right? So to get around that, you can do acoustic tagging. So inserting a little an acoustic transmitter that can track whether, essentially or not, it survives, right? So you have receivers set around, and as the shark swims by, it will ping, and that will let you know that the shark is in the area. You can do different types of satellite tags, but there's a lot of issues with those, and, you know, again, technology in the ocean is complicated, so, and there's a lot of malfunctions. So short answer is, again, not really. We don't know. We have captured small nurse sharks within 24 hours and have seen a full recovery in the variables that we measured. But again, that's small juvenile nurse sharks. It might be different for a tiger shark or a great hammerhead or a sandbar or a black tip. So it really does vary and kind of depends on the species.
Jake, is there anything else that we didn't go over that you think would be important for us to touch base on about either stress physiology or how you conducted this experiment, or anything that you might do differently if you could go back and do it again?
Yeah, so, you know, with any study, there's always something that you want to do differently, right? You want to kind of perfect your methods. For a lot of stress physiology work, it's really important to be able to replicate a certain type of stress. So for a fishing stress, whether that's time on the line, if it is air exposure, if it's handling, whatever it may be, there's a lot of kind of moving parts. And so it's very, very complicated to say that this caused this, really. It's kind of just trying to find these small pieces to kind of put together in this bigger picture. So I definitely would have liked to have a little bit larger sample size for some of the species.
Jake, it is time for our favorite part of the podcast, which is when we ask for your favorite field story.
So I think my favorite field story, which both of you probably know, but for the listeners, is back in 2015, working with Dr. Dean Grubbs and Dr. Andrea Croats and some other scientists from NOAA, down in Andros in the Bahamas. And our research vessel was helping, our research team was helping them collect data as well as kind of providing support for their expedition. So some of the staff got to kind of tag along for some of the days, and the goal of the research was to find sawfish. So looking around Andros for these large sawfish. And I was very excited because I had never seen a sawfish before. And it kind of seemed like this mythical creature that I would never see, right? They're critically endangered. They're pretty rare. And so the first day, I was lucky enough to be able to go out with Nick, another staff member of field school. And on the second set of long lines, we happened to capture a 14-foot female sawfish. I was completely in awe. And it was also, it was a very, very exciting moment. The kind of cherry on top here is that whenever they were kind of flipping the sawfish over in order to do the acoustic surgeries, we realized that she was in the middle of giving birth. So this 14-foot female sawfish was in the middle of pupping while we were doing the workup. And essentially, Dean Grubbs assisted in some of that birth and pulled out some of these baby sawfish. And we were actually able to sample them. And it was really, really cool because it was the first confirmation that sawfish were actually pupping in that area. So it was really, really big scientifically, but also super, super cool experience to to be able to see a saltfish pup. It was the first time that it was kind of, again, documented in the area. Always take a GoPro with you, people, because I filmed it. Luckily, had a GoPro with me, and it's the only footage of a saltfish birth. At one point, I was holding two baby saltfish in my hands, kind of wielding them like swords. There's a really funny video of me. I kind of like set the GoPro down on the edge of the boat, and you can see me holding two baby saltfish and just look at the camera and smiling ear to ear, like, what the hell is happening right now? So yeah, it was a super, super cool experience. Definitely will probably never happen again in my life, and I don't think I can top it.
That's a really good field story.
Yeah, it was an incredible scene. I mean, and it's a testament to the team that they had working there and being organized, because you have a 14-foot saltfish you're trying to collect data on, and then all of a sudden five pups. And so you're holding multiple animals, you're trying to collect all these data, you're trying to keep samples straight for which animal they belong to. And so working with a good team, which we had, was imperative. But again, it was the highlight of my field work, I think, ever and will ever be, for sure.
How many pups did you see that day?
So we saw five pups in total. So we think that she was kind of going up into that mangrove estuary to give birth. And it just kind of started to happen as she was caught on the line. I'm not sure what the kind of estimated range is for number of pups. I think it can be up to 7 or 10, maybe. So maybe it was a low number, maybe some kind of spat out before, maybe there were some still in there. Our kind of goal was to get all of the workup and data collected as quick as possible on the larger individual.
Yeah, no kidding.
And send her on her way.
That's so awesome. And like the best field story you could possibly have in your back pocket for occasions just like this.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Jig. I love talking about physiology. I've learned so much from you, and I'm excited for our Sharkies to learn from you as well. This is a cool study, and I think, you know, like we were talking about earlier, we all have something to contribute, and we got to start somewhere, because I think physiology is still like such a growing field, and we're just like barely at the beginning of it for sharks, and I'm super excited to see where else we can go with it.
Definitely. Thank you guys so much for having me. I super had fun.
Good.
Yeah, of course. We love having you on. And where can our Sharkies find you or follow your work?
So our in general research, you can follow at Field School on Instagram, Twitter. If you want to follow me personally, it's just my name, Jake_Jerome on Instagram and Twitter as well.
Awesome. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes so everyone can find you. Well, thank you so much again, Jake. We always have a good time hanging out with you, hearing about your crazy sawfish stories and blood stories alike. All right, Sharkies. Until next time,
swim you later.